Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Keller McFall from Newman University, and I'm a host on the show. And just last night, I opened my New York Times app on my phone, and I discovered an article with a title that asked whether the increasing number of people buying second homes in small towns in Wales and the increasing presence of those owners who spoke English, who out-negotiated the original inhabitants of these homes. And so the original owners of the home or people who rented in those homes had to leave and just generally transformed those towns. The title asked whether this was, in fact, a form of cultural genocide. And it was interestingly timed, given that I was going to talk today with Jeffrey Bachman, who's written edited a fabulous book, published in 2019, but now out in paperback, called Cultural Genocide, Law, Politics, and Global Manifestations. It's published by Routledge, and it's this really interesting set of essays that asks questions about what cultural genocide is and what drives it and how we should respond. And it was in my mind the whole time when I was reading this New York Times article. And so I'm thrilled to get to talk to Jeff about this today. Jeff is a senior professorial lecturer at the American University in Washington, D.C., and interested in the study of genocide and of human rights more broadly. And so, Jeff, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It'll be interesting to be on the other side of the mic for this one.
Yes, and I didn't say, Jeff is a co-host on the channel. You've heard his voice before, I'm sure. I love listening to his interviews, and I'm excited to give him a chance to talk about his work this time. So that's a tiny bit about you, Jeff, but let's give you a chance to talk a little bit. How did you become an academic? What made you interested in these issues of human rights and genocide and violence?
Thanks again, Kelly. You know, it's interesting to sort of date myself. I was a senior in high school in 1994, and I was actually taking a elective history course that was on contemporary issues. And, you know, the Rwandan genocide, of course, had started in April of 1994. And so we did spend some time on the Rwandan genocide. And, you know, at the time being 18, I was a little maybe naive in terms of understanding how politics work. It was hard to imagine why isn't something being done to stop this. And of course, a whole episode could be on how the genocide was being framed at the time. But nonetheless, we knew lots of people were dying, and it just, you know, astounded me. I didn't understand why nothing was being done. And that just, you know, a little bit about, you know, what led me ultimately to genocide studies. I don't want to get into too long of an explanation. I'll say that my undergraduate studies, I was sort of encouraged, I'll put it, to study something that my dad believed would have a longer career outcome. And so I studied business and I also surfed, and I actually used my business degree to get a job at Ron John Surf Shop in at the Jersey Shore. And I realized at the time, you know, this just wasn't fulfilling to me. And so then I last minute applied to a master's program in composition and rhetoric, and because I've always had an interest in how language has been used for persuasion, but also for manipulation. And so I did a master's in comp and rhetoric. And then I was teaching writing courses as an adjunct. And I realized I was basically turning my writing courses into writing intensive, like international studies courses. And so that's when I realized, well, maybe I should, if I want to be teaching what I want to be teaching, maybe I should go on for doctoral studies. And you know, I applied to the doctoral program at Northeastern University, and it was a interdisciplinary program, which was great. I got to take a course on media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but I was also taking a course at the law school on international human rights law. And then I ultimately did my my dissertation on the Genocide Convention and the evolution of the language for preventive purposes, because there was so much research on the punitive aspect. And I wanted to see, well, how did the language evolve in terms of genocide prevention? And yeah, so that's sort of tying together, I hope, you know, how I both became an academic and, you know, and genocide studies. And, you know, the last thing I'll note is I did spend a year at Amnesty International in 2004. And it was a really interesting time to be there. There were discussions about the Darfur genocide and whether or not to call it genocide. And this was also somewhat illuminating to me, just to sort of the discussions that go on about when to use certain words to describe things. And it made me, you know, think back to, you know, the Rwandan genocide, when there was like, you know, the United States, there was that those documents or memos saying, you know, be careful calling it genocide. Legal's concerned that we might actually have to do something if we call it that. And so it fed into this interest in how we use discourse to maybe push for certain outcomes that are preferred by the actors involved. So sorry if that was a long answer, but yeah. My point of bringing up Amnesty International was simply that, wasn't sure if I wanted to do the NGO route after gaining that experience, because as I'm sure you're aware, as an academic also, we have a lot more freedom. Like I'm not representing Amnesty International or some other organization as an academic. We're essentially representing on ourselves, but also our universities. And I found the academic freedom part of being able to focus on what I want to be focusing on, when I want to be focusing on it, was more attractive to me than the NGO route.
Okay, so do you still surf?
I have. It's funny. The last time I surfed, even though I'm about 3 hours from Ocean City, Maryland, the last time I surfed was in La Jolla Beach. It's so for some reason I've surfed in San Diego, but I've never. Well, I'm not never, but it's been probably 10 years since I've surfed on the East Coast, which is very strange since I live essentially on the East Coast. It's something I would really like to do more of. It just never seems like there's enough time.
I was going to say, you've just confirmed every undergraduate's perception of academics, that they've chosen to sit and read and write books rather than surf. Right. But
I do play pickleball now, though, which I know is the craze right now. So.
It is indeed. And that, so does my wife. And so thus do I. So so actually, let me ask, what this is not your first work. So what have you done in the past? What books and things have you concentrated on before? You talked about the Genocide Convention. How what is your path to this book?
So my dissertation, as I mentioned, was on the evolution of the preventive language. And it's interesting, after I finished that, I actually sort of ran away from genocide studies a little bit. It had been such a huge part of both my academic and my regular life. And at the time, there was so much being revealed about the targeted killing and drone strikes program. And so I spent a few years writing about that, everything from how the New York Times and Washington Post covered drone strikes, and especially in their immediate aftermath, to where do drone strikes fit in human rights law and international humanitarian law. And then later, a related piece on discourse analysis that I co-wrote with a scholar based at Leeds University, or University of Leeds, I may have gotten that wrong, Jack Holland, on national security speeches that were used to justify drone strikes. And you know, what's always sort of present in the work that I'm doing is the role the United States plays in the world. And so, my first book that preceded the edited volume is titled The United States and Genocide, Redefining the Relationship. And it uses the Bosnia versus Serbia case. And for those who maybe aren't familiar, the International Court of Justice deals with disputes between states in the world, and Bosnia brought a case against Serbia for its alleged role in the genocide at Srebrenica in 1995. And what the International Court of Justice did was set a number of precedents about what constitutes failure to prevent genocide, what obligations states have, what is complicity in genocide, what does it mean to conspire to commit genocide, and so on. And I use that framework to look at the U.S. relationships with Indonesia during the 65-66 massacres. I mean, I would call it genocide, but political groups are not included in the Genocide Convention. So technically, legally, it doesn't sort of fall there. But also the U.S. relationship with Pakistan in 1971, when, I would argue genocide was committed in East Pakistan, present-day Bangladesh, with Rios Montt in Guatemala, with Saddam Hussein during the Kurdish genocide in Iraq. And just to kind of show that, basically my argument is that Samantha Power, who wrote, what will probably be the best-selling genocide studies book of all time, for all time, what I argue is sort of, criticized U.S. foreign policy around the sort of acceptable margins, but didn't go far enough in terms of how, she approached the U.S. relationship. And so that was that. And, obviously the connection is with the, U.S. and human rights with the drone strikes. And so that tends to be a underlying theme in a lot of the research.
So let's turn to this book, and I'll ask the basic obvious question first. The book is titled Cultural Genocide. How do you define cultural genocide?
So in the book, I didn't want to, I'll back up one sec. There's different forms that we talk about, right? So the book is divided into two sections, one on sort of forced assimilation, colonial settler, and so on. And then the second part is on more focused on tangible cultural destruction. So the destruction of artifacts, monuments, essentially like UNESCO, but cultural heritage that has been recognized as fundamental, to the sort of world culture. And so the definition I used in the book was an attempt not to impose any one definition. And so I borrowed from Damien Short, who has a book called Redefining Genocide, which is actually a book I would recommend. And it was defined as, quote, a method of genocide which destroys a social group through the destruction of their culture. And so this, I thought, would leave it kind of open-ended for scholars to approach the topic of cultural genocide without feeling like they have to fit it into a box.
So why this book now?
So this is also interesting. Because of my dissertation research, one thing I did notice, first of all, is the language in the Genocide Convention does change. And so, we can certainly talk about Raphael Lemkin if you'd like. But in the early draft of the Genocide Convention, the Secretariat draft, it had and pretty exhaustive definition of cultural genocide. And cultural genocide was also included along physical genocide and biological genocide in the same article. So essentially cultural genocide was, placed as an equal, even if it's a different degree or different form, is placed equally alongside the other methods. And then in the ad hoc committee draft, which came, a little later and was being negotiated by seven states cultural genocide was kind of pared down quite a bit. And then it ultimately was separated from physical and biological genocide at the behest of the United States. And essentially the reasoning was that if it's separated, the United States and other states that oppose cultural genocide could submit a reservation. So they could basically say, we recognize physical and biological genocide as methods of genocide in Article 2, but we don't recognize cultural genocide. And then ultimately, though, cultural genocide was removed from the adopted text, the text that was adopted in December of 1948. The United States was one of the more aggressive states in opposition, essentially threatening to undermine the viability of the treaty through its influence over other states. And so cultural genocide was removed. There's also part of a compromise. You know, the Soviet Union didn't want political groups protected. And so ultimately political groups were removed. Cultural genocide was removed. And so, you know, that was part of my, you know, reason for ultimately editing this volume. But also an interesting exchange I had with a colleague who I was presenting at a conference. This was probably way back in 2013 or so. And before I even got out of my mouth, my perception of cultural genocide or my position, it was kind of scoffed at that this idea that cultural genocide could be genocide. And so that was, you know, it was a sort of informative, what's the word I'm looking for? Informative exchange. And you know, the other thing was there was so little literature at the time on cultural genocide. And I had actually complained to my partner, now wife, Jeannie, about this. And she's like, well, why don't you add to the literature then? It's like, oh, yeah, like, as what a great idea. And so, you know, I had worked with Adam Jones, who's the editor of the series for Routledge on genocide and crimes against humanity. And so once I had the book on US and genocide, it's like, well, maybe I should talk to Adam about, you know, the possibility of doing this edited volume. And you know, so I developed this proposal and got a great group of contributors together. And ultimately, it was contracted. And yeah, I'm very happy about it. It's at the time, I counted it being as only the third book that focuses entirely on cultural genocide. And it was the first edited volume that's bringing all these diverse cases and perspectives together. And so, yeah.
So for those listeners who are new to the podcast, Adam's been on at least a couple times, maybe more than that. And he's always insightful and interesting. And so I encourage you to go back and listen to those. In particular, he and John Cox were on to talk about the process of writing textbooks about genocide, which I thought was a really interesting interview. So I want to get back to this comment you mentioned by the colleague at the conference. But before we do that, maybe just a little attention to historical case studies. And you write about the situation or the case of indigenous people in the United States. And for listeners who aren't familiar with that, can you say just a little bit about the ways, the kinds of treatment that were imposed or the kinds of behaviors and actions that were imposed on indigenous people in the United States and why you think that amounts to cultural genocide?
Sure. So, and this, you know, will give also a little bit of insight into why the United States maybe didn't want cultural genocide included in the Genocide Convention. And I can give the reasons that they gave for why they wanted it omitted. But if we put it in this historical context that you just asked about, it certainly maybe give some ideas of why, how there may have been some incentives for making sure it was removed. And so, you know, this is part of a sort of shift in terms of U.S. policy towards the indigenous communities in the United States. And I mean, there's a famous quote that some listeners may be familiar with that maybe summarizes it, and then I can go into some of the specifics. And it's, quote, kill the Indian to save the man, or kill the Indian, save the man, end quote. And the idea was, you know, essentially to anglicize indigenous youth. And part of this was there was an idea that the older generations of indigenous peoples were too set in their quote unquote heathen ways. And so therefore, there was this idea of targeting the youth. And one of the main pathways to targeting the youth was through education. And that's where, you know, the residential schools came into play. And you know, so students were, youth were removed from their families, put into these schools. They were given Anglo names, haircuts, educated in oftentimes Christianity. And then the practices, customs, traditions, the use of the language was prohibited. And in some cases, there was what's the word I'm looking for here? It's escaping me, but essentially extreme forms of punishment, including physical punishment for violating these prohibitions. And so, it's interesting because at the same time that they were being anglicized, I don't think there was ever really an understanding that even if they succeeded in anglicizing these youth, that they would ever be treated with the same dignity and respect of white children. This was basically their attempt to quote unquote civilize indigenous peoples in the United States, but not necessarily with the purpose of bringing them up to, you know, what they would say the same level as the white children or then therefore white adults.
And I want to, I should have said this initially, I want to point out that chapter in the book was co-authored, and I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce her last name, Lauren Karasik, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Something I was just going to add, so if we think about why the United States wanted cultural genocide removed, we can also look at the other colonial powers, because the United Kingdom and France were also opposed to the inclusion. And they had, of course, colonies in all over the world, but Africa in particular. And one of the things that I don't know if I argue in this book, but I have elsewhere, is that they didn't need to be sure that they were committing cultural genocide or not committing it. Just the possibility that they could be implicated in the commission of genocide would be incentive enough. And what they did during the negotiations is seek to essentially trivialize things that constituted cultural genocide. So they equated cultural genocide to burning books, and burning books or destroying books was an element of cultural genocide. But you know, they were basically arguing this is a minority rights issue. So this should be in a human rights convention. We should not be equating something, the physical destruction of a group with burning books, which, you know, I certainly think understates the impacts of cultural genocide or acts that would have constituted cultural genocide had they been included.
So you have a variety of other case studies, and I should say many of these case studies focus or serve both to illustrate the case study, but also to make a broader point about cultural genocide. And so I wonder, without asking you to go through each of those case studies, which is unfair and impossible given the time constraints, I wonder what broad themes emerge from those case studies. As an editor, as you're reading all of these essays together for the first or second or probably 15th time, what do you see coming out of these collectively that you might not notice or maybe that are emphasized collectively that are not as important when you look at one case study at a time?
Sure. So, you know, in case after case, I should, you know, maybe give a brief overview of cases. So, the first part of the book deals with international law. And so, Doug Irvin Erickson has a piece on Raphael Lemkin and, how we should understand Lemkin's own position on cultural genocide, or and the destruction of a nation. Then I have a piece that I've already given a little bit of insights into on how cultural genocide ended up being excluded from the convention. And then David Nersessian has a chapter on more recent developments that sort of set case law precedent and other things around elements of what we call cultural genocide. And then there's a chapter on Australia that Martin Short is an actor. Damien Short, excuse me, and Martin Crook on Australia and ecocide as it contributes to and capitalism and how it creates these extractive industries and its impact on indigenous peoples. Jenna Nasace has a chapter on an indigenous group in Brazil and how agribusiness there is affecting indigenous ways of life and ways of being. And Shell Anderson has one on West Papua and what he describes as cold genocide or slow motion genocide there. And then it does turn to cultural destruction. And Helen Malko has a chapter on Iraq and the so-called Islamic State and its destruction of cultural heritage. Mujahid Momin has one on the Baha'i and Iran. And Dawood Abdullah has one on Palestine. And then, and this is a little bit separate, we, you know, happy to come back to it, but Andrew Wolford has a great chapter on transitional justice. And I give you all that background just to kind of get to that, you know, in case after case, you know, the persecution of particular groups and attacks on their shared cultural identity and the heritage had and continue to have consequences for affected peoples that extend well beyond the immediate harm. Cultural genocide affects group cohesion. It affects identity, memory, and way of life. And the cases in the book illustrate the ways such ill treatment and attacks that threaten the very existence of group as such. And I think "as such" is really a key part of this because, you know, when we talk about physical destruction, we're talking about attempts to destroy the group by killing off the group, essentially. And that can happen through immediate physical violence. I mean, if you think about biological, that can also be sort of like a cutting off point, right? So if you are forcibly marrying members of one group into another, and then the children that they produce are in that group, it may take longer than direct physical violence. But ultimately, when coupled with physical violence, you can imagine how a group's existence, even if not 100% being wiped out, could be destroyed to the point where you know, the group barely exists as a group. But you know, "as such" I think is an important part for the cultural genocide aspect because you know, we're not necessarily talking about, although cultural genocide can certainly be accompanied by other forms of attempts at destroying the group. If you destroy the group's identity, if you erase the group's previous existence, and if you discontinue the group's ability to produce its unique cultural heritage, then you are destroying the group as such by taking away, you know, their unique identity. And so, you know, the persecution of groups and the attacks on their cultural heritage have often been part and parcel to a broader, what I would say, you know, Lemkin puts as a synchronized attack on different aspects of life. And that's a, you know, I think then therefore cultural genocide and the study of it sort of returns us to a more holistic understanding of genocide rather than focusing solely on genocide as being the end goal, the end result being the eraser of the group physically from the earth.
So most certainly cultural genocide, the genocides of in the U.S. or North America more broadly, and Australia encompass a period of time before the mid-1800s. But broadly, all of these case studies are modern case studies. I wonder if that's on purpose, if that's because of a perspective on cultural genocide that mostly limits cultural genocide to the modern period, or whether that's a matter of convenience. You could find authors who could talk about that, who are willing to write. And then more broadly, what do you imagine including earlier case studies might do to the broader perspective on cultural genocide?
Sure. So the main reason why the cases that were chosen have a particular temporal, you know, sort of bracket is the focus was on cases that, I mean, some, you know, certainly preceded the Genocide Convention, but they continued on after. And so the idea was a more modern history because you know, we're working on current or modern international law. You know, the indigenous cases that are in the book and that you mentioned certainly extend beyond 1948. And then many of the cases then, of course, are even more recent in history. So that was really the main focus there. You know, I'm not a historian, so I don't want to speak in ways, you know, on things I'm not overly familiar with. But I certainly think if you could, you know, back up from there, to the age of exploration, and look at you know, some of the earlier times when Europeans sail to other parts of the world, including the Americas. And then if you go even further back, again, I don't want to speak on things I don't know, but I would imagine that there were destruction of cultures through that was associated more with the physical violence that came rather than cultural genocide alone, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's I think there's one of the things this book does so well is point out the gaps in the literature, and one of the gaps that is implicit is this concentration on modernity and the modern period. And so for enterprising graduate students who are out here hoping to use this as a shortcut to complete your general exam, your comprehensive exams more easily, there's a space for dissertations out there from periods before this. So
eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you, let me come back to this comment your colleague made. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the way in which genocide studies as a field has tried to wrestle with this notion of cultural genocide. Why has it become increasingly interesting? That's not the right word, but why have genocide studies people increasingly focused on this now as opposed to 30 years ago? What are some of the concerns genocide scholars have about the notion of cultural genocide? And how have people responded to those concerns?
Yeah, so, I guess maybe one place to start would be, the early genocide studies is predominantly sort of known for Holocaust studies, which then evolved into genocide studies, and then particularly into comparative genocide studies. So, I'm thinking about there wasn't a lot of focus on genocide studies for some period after the Holocaust. But then as it emerged, focusing on Nazism, certainly we can look at Lemkin's Axis powers in occupied Europe. But in the early 80s, there was this rise of comparative genocide studies. And I don't think it was probably until the last 15 years or so that we really saw a movement towards focusing on cultural genocide. And I think part of this has come in greater attention being paid to indigenous peoples. We have the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that was in the 2000s. But in the scholarly literature, there's been a reluctance to recognize cultural genocide, and that's generally speaking. Part of this, I think, Ben Michie's has a book that talks about the hegemonic understanding of genocide and genocide being synonymous with mass killing. Some would point to Alex Hinton has the genocide studies canon and the prototype being the Holocaust. And if it doesn't look like the Holocaust, then, it's not treated the same way within genocide studies. which is, you know, I think kind of interesting because there were certainly elements of cultural genocide, you know, present in during the Holocaust. And, you know, it wasn't just the, and I don't mean just to trivialize, but it wasn't the mass killings were not the only forms of genocide that occurred there. But, you know, I did a little bit of research for the introduction for the book, and I looked at, there's a survey of genocide studies, alternative definitions of genocide, and Scott Strauss published an article on this, and Adam Jones includes this in his book, Genocide, A Comprehensive Introduction. And, you know, it was massively, the definitions include mass killing, and typically a substantial number of people, of members of the group. You know, biological genocide was included in a number of the definitions as well. But there were very few that included included cultural genocide. And so, you know, the evolution, I think, in terms of the recognition, I guess I should take one step back. And I'm starting to lose my train of thought, but, you know, cultural genocide is something that a lot of scholars, I think, would say is not genocide itself unless it's accompanied by physical attacks on members of the group. And even in some of the international criminal jurisprudence, there was, you know, cultural genocide is not genocide, but it could be evidence of the intent to commit genocide. And so if we think about, you know, the records of the plans of the Nazi Party, it was very clear what their intentions were. But states don't always announce that they are intending to destroy a group. And so, you know, the basically the law says, or the precedent was that if physical killing is happening and they're also destroying the culture and prohibiting cultural practices and so on, then we can infer that they are intending to commit genocide by those two things happening simultaneously. And so I do think, you know, that this renewed focus on the rights of indigenous peoples is why we're seeing a resurgence of focus on cultural genocide and ideas about what cultural genocide is, and that it is, in fact, genocide, you know, whether or not it's accompanied by other acts. And, you know, one thing I'll just quickly note is, you know, something I also talk about at the introduction is, you know, I don't know how many times I've said cultural genocide on the podcast, but does putting cultural in front of the term genocide reinforce the idea that it's not genocide? Because we don't talk about physical genocide. We say genocide or biological, but every time I say cultural genocide, am I contributing to sort of a hierarchy of genocidal acts? And it's a, you know, I'm not the first one to wrestle with this, but at the same time, it almost seems necessary to have the qualifier in front so that we know what we're talking about. And so, yeah, there's a, I don't know if it's counterproductive or not, but yeah.
I was going to say, longtime listeners who listen to other channels recognize that I sometimes pinch hit on new books in sports, and I have an interest in women's sports history. And I was just looking at my channel guide yesterday and looking at a listing for college basketball and flipping to find out whether it was men's or women's basketball before recognizing that it is standard simply to identify basketball as men's basketball and then to attach women's to it if you have to, if in order to communicate to people that it's women playing, and it's the same kind of issue.
I did not know that there was a podcast channel on that.
New Books in Sports. Yes, it's when I've read too much about death and destruction, I can go and do something that's at least occasionally more hopeful. So you raise a couple, you point out a couple of objections that genocide scholars sometimes raise in the book, and one of them is that it's hard enough to get the international community to care about physical genocide that involves mass killings. And given that, while cultural genocide is tragic, we should focus our attention on physical genocides and trying to elevate cultural genocide risks diluting our effort and attention. I wonder how you would respond to that.
So, I mean, I understand the perspective, but And I agree that it is hard enough to get attention paid to physical genocide and, you know, the immediate threat to physical integrity that is involved. But I don't think that's in my opinion, it's the sentiment I think is valid, but the idea that there should be essentially a hierarchy of suffering is something that I do find problematic. If we think about, putting it maybe in the context of direct physical violence versus structural violence, the idea that this is most important because, people are dying and that of course is significant. But that people should just sort of wait because their long-term suffering, is something that, that does not involve necessarily this immediate threat to physical integrity is to essentially tell them that, you have to wait until we deal with this before, we focus on your suffering. And I think that in some ways normalizes that this you have to tolerate, but this is unacceptable. Physical, direct physical violence is unacceptable, but we have to tolerate other forms of suffering. And I think, we can accept or acknowledge that there are different degrees of violence committed in genocide, but that does not mean one has to be elevated above another, if that makes sense.
And then a second, not equivalent critique, but a challenge from the other direction to this notion of cultural genocide, I think, comes from Andrew Wolfart, who also has been on the program before. And in his chapter in your book, he argues that many people who talk about cultural genocide have adopted a westernized understanding of cultural genocide that divorces things like language and literary traditions and forms of dress from it divorces that from ways that some groups, often indigenous groups, have relationships to land and to territory that are intrinsic in their understanding of themselves as groups. And so the way that we now talk about cultural genocide leads to notions of redress and justice that ignore the idea that for Indigenous peoples to not have the traditional relationship to their land means that they are not the same people. So I wonder, I don't know how recently you've read his chapter, but how does Wolfart's notion that we need to expand the idea of cultural genocide to include physical and geographic and economic elements? What did you think of that when you looked at that chapter?
Sure, thank you. If you don't mind, can I add one more thing to the previous,
yeah, please,
and then
go
I'll
ahead.
Get to that.
Yep.
Yeah. So because one thing I did want to mention about this sort of physical genocide versus cultural genocide and the direct violence versus longer term destruction, or what I would argue is destruction, is it has transitional justice or justice impacts as well as restoration. Going back to the argument I made about the U.S., that the U.S. made against cultural genocide, that burning books and mass killings are on completely different levels. As you noted, it's challenging enough for restoration and repair, let alone prevention, but also, restoration, repair in the aftermath of violence on a massive scale. But this again does make it more challenging for acts of cultural genocide to be recognized, to be acknowledged, to be placed rightfully in our historical memory, restoration and repair of what was impacted or destroyed, with restoration and repair in some cases, being impossible. Something that is irreplaceable if it's destroyed is gone forever. Examples of, the lack of justice for, these historical acts that I describe as cultural genocide. And in the American context, President Obama in 2009 actually recognized and apologized for the treatment of Native Americans, but it also foreclosed legal recourse for individuals and ancestors If we also could, we could look at the Truth Commission for Canada and how it used cultural genocide in quotes. It said, we did all of these things, but you know, there's no legal grounding because cultural genocide was removed from the Genocide Convention. And so, you know, it's in some ways it's hard to get cultural genocide recognized, but in some ways it's also potentially easier than getting genocide recognized because of the lack of legal recourse associated. And I think this does connect to, you know, to Andrew's contribution. You know, Andrew raises important questions about what actually constitutes justice for Indigenous peoples. And, you know, I'll get to the other thing about, you know, the on cultural genocide. But, you know, when we discuss transitional justice, as Andrew argues, then we often do so in terms of our societies and our understandings, such as retributive justice. Even when we talk about restorative and reparative justice, oftentimes it's defined, you know, how we define and what survivors and victims should get in terms of restoration and repair. And so you asked, you know, how recently I read Andrew's chapter, and I gave it a look, you know, leading up to our interview here. And, you know, if you don't mind, I would share an excerpt from it. So Andrew writes, quote, without taking away what compensation and symbolic address, redress might mean to an individual survivor of Canada's Indian residential school system, which is where, you know, how Andrew situated his chapter, these redress measures do not move beyond symbolic forms. Even the compensation is largely symbolic, since it obviously cannot ameliorate the levels of harm experienced by survivors. More to the point of this chapter, though, the measures also fail to grapple with the ontological destruction perpetrated by Canadian settler colonialism. The key sources of Indigenous collective becoming, namely territory, language, kin, other than human relations, and story, the very things that were targeted through the compulsory transfer of Indigenous children to assimilative schools, are barely registered in the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. Andrew also writes in the conclusion of his chapter, quote, cultural genocide is rarely ever singularly cultural. When the cultural techniques of destruction, such as forced assimilation through residential schools, sever relationships between Indigenous children and their families, territories, language, and other than human relations, they also strike at the very material existence of the group. This is an ontological destruction that targets the complex intersections of nature and culture that make possible ongoing processes of group becoming. To name this as cultural genocide and then to seek to repair it through restorative justice or reconciliation is to miss this larger point. In fact, the naming threatens a form of epistemological violence as it imposes a way of seeing the world as well as a pathway to redress that fails to listen to what Indigenous scholars and leaders are telling us. And I think, you know, that's a really, really powerful, statement, I guess, yeah, that Andrew is putting forth there. Because as you mentioned, it situates cultural genocide as something that's not just cultural. It's not just sort of prohibiting or impeding the process of cultural reproduction, but it actually has direct physical and material impacts on the people whose cultures have been threatened through these various practices. And then on top of that, even when we start talking about what justice means or what justice ought to look like for, say, Indigenous peoples who are seeking justice and redress, that if we start putting justice in our terms, and maybe there's some sort of financial thing, or maybe there's some limited portion of land, or maybe they get to they have fishing rights that you know, that large scale fishers don't have. It's not really necessarily addressing the larger issues that need to be addressed, and so then it's almost like adding on to the indignities that have already been suffered by looking at justice through our lens rather than their own.
So we've talked for quite a while. I guess I'd ask a couple. I don't know if practical is the right word, but kind of concluding questions. And one is one. I guess I'll circle back to what your very first answer about how you became interested in genocide studies. And it's an answer I've got from a lot of people when I ask this question, and it's in fact my own. I was a little older than you. I was in graduate school during the Rwandan and Bosnian genocide, but that's what particularly made me aware of the field and made me passionate about pursuing it. So if you, having worked on this project, if you were talking to policymakers or people trying to influence policy, what takeaways come out of this book? What would you want them to hear?
This is not going to be profound, but it's, you know, because it's out there already. But I think, you know, a number of things, if we just take the United States context, and there's been, I forget what the name of, there was some recent, conference that I think was on a sort of truth commission. But it didn't involve policymakers or, elected officials. I think it was largely activists, advocates, and academics. But I do think, we're beyond the point where, the United States, should have some form of, truth and reconciliation. And this is for, both, indigenous peoples, but also African Americans. I think it should encompass, as much as possible, as many historical, what I would say are crimes, as possible. Cause, I'm actually working on a paper right now, and I know that, I assume that you end with a question like this.
Yes, so I
hate to jump the shark, but, and I don't think that's the right way to use that. I think to move forward, we have to address things that have happened in the past. And otherwise, some would say we're destined to repeat these things, but it's not, for me, it's not even repeating. It's that we're continuing them rather than repeating them. I think we need to tie things that are happening today to, to our history. And so I think we need acknowledgement, we need reparations, but at the same time, as I mentioned with Andrew's chapter, it has to be, through the informed consent of the people, whose communities have suffered. So I think that's the biggest thing, and I don't think that has to be limited to the United States. I don't think the United States is alone in a lack of willingness to acknowledge its history. We could look at Turkey and the Armenian genocide as an example. But if we really are going to move forward, then I think we have to acknowledge and document the past. So, Truth and Reconciliation Commissions have an educational effect as well, because the proceedings are recorded and it's out there for everyone to see. And I think that, a simple apology is just insufficient when we're talking about the scale of, the impacts of historical policies on different communities.
So a related question, if you're now instead of talking to policymakers, you're talking to people who are in the genocide studies community, what new kinds of questions or what gaps should they be thinking about? What do you want this book to stimulate in terms of further research?
In terms of further research, I may actually say something about this in the book. I should have refreshed myself. If you don't mind me putting a slightly different spin on it,
go ahead.
Thinking more of, broadly for genocide studies, Dirk Moses has a book that just came out that I had the chance to interview him about, called The Problems of Genocide, A Permanent Security and the Language of Transgression. And, it's a 500 or so page book, so there's so much more in it than I'm about to say. But, Dirk does raise some concerns about the international criminal hierarchy. And I mentioned, a hierarchy of human suffering earlier in our discussion. And I think it's really important for genocide studies to continue, because I think it's happening, but to continue to move out of a sort of silo that I think it has had operated in for a long time, to look at other forms of violence and suffering. And, we could think about, something's not genocide, but that doesn't mean that the human suffering involved should be completely removed from our genocide studies lens. And, I'm thinking about, Dirk raises a question. He says something like, for victims of genocide and quote unquote collateral damage, you know, what really is the difference in terms of, the suffering, especially if they're, you know, if they're both innocent. And I really messed up that quote. I apologize, Dirk, if you listen to this. But I think that's important. And, one of the things I'm looking at or will be looking at, hopefully, is what I would argue is a nexus between aggressive war and genocide, including, in a comparison of genocide propaganda and war propaganda, to see if there are comparisons that can be made between the dehumanization of the people who, are ultimately killed or affected in other ways. I wrote a piece called The Four Schools of Thought on the Relationship Between War and Genocide. Mm-hmm. I did find this really adamant position among some genocide scholars that war crimes are war crimes and genocide is genocide. When we compare the two, mm-hmm. we're doing a disservice to the victims of genocide. I don't think that's necessarily the case, especially when we think about what the intentions are in aggressive war, and then look at, and how that can be compared to the intent in genocide. So, mm-hmm.
So I'll circle back then to the story I told at the beginning. Is there a danger of pushing this notion of cultural violence or cultural genocide too far? Is it legitimate to claim that because people are buying second houses in your village, that this is a form of cultural genocide?
So I did not know that about that story.
And it's not fair. You haven't read the story. So.
But I think it's an interesting question. And I'm going to sort of maybe cop out a little on the answer by going to Lemkin. Lemkin talked about different phases of genocide and, one being the forced removal of a group and then imposing, the political and social and, legal and whatever, all the institutions on that land. So now you've basically erased the existence from a particular area. And then there's also leaving, allowing people to stay, but also imposing the institutions of the group that is now occupying that land. I'd have a hard time calling what you describe from this article as cultural genocide. But it does raise, I think, important issues around human rights. If we look at gentrification, in the United States context, I do think that if from these transatlantic slave trade all the way up to today, that there have been efforts, including some that are documented in the pamphlet/book We Charge Genocide, that extend beyond gentrification, that you could raise questions about cultural genocide in the United States. But what you're describing from the article, I'm not sure if I could say without more in-depth.
Sure. I'm less interested in the article itself as in wondering where the outer bounds of this definition are about this discussion about what is and is not cultural genocide. I think the field has quite appropriately pushed those definitional boundaries outward. Mm-hmm. But I wonder where that process ends. Presumably there is an end somewhere, and I'm not sure where that is. And that may be something that this discussion continues, that comes up.
Yeah. I think a case by case basis also helps. Yeah. So you can look at the particular features of each. Just out of curiosity, I know we're getting long. Yeah. Where was this article published? Because I'm surprised. If was this a mainstream media publication?
That was the New York Times yesterday. So
really,
yeah,
that's interesting.
So, and I have to confess, it was late at night, and I'd been pretending to grade papers, so I may not have read it as cogently as I would have liked. But we are a little long, and so I want to say thank you so much for joining us. And you've answered already at least a little bit one of my concluding questions, and so I will give my usual answer, which is that when you finish these projects, I'd love to have you come back and talk to us again. But you haven't yet answered the first one of my concluding questions, and so I'll offer you this opportunity. Thanksgiving is coming, and I'm sure my students will be pretending to do homework, and I'll be pretending to grade. And so what should I be reading? What would you suggest that I read or the audience reads or watches or listens to that's important, that has been important to you as you've thought about this subject?
Sure. I mentioned in the interview that I use a definition of cultural genocide from Damien Short. I highly recommend his book, Redefining Genocide, Settler Colonialism, Social Death, and Ecocide. Really interesting book. And, you know, this idea of social death builds off of, Claudia Card. I know all our listeners will not be able to access journal articles, but if you do have access, Claudia Card has a great article on social death and genocide. But for those who are interested in learning more about treatment of Indigenous peoples in the United States and from an Indigenous writer's perspective, I highly recommend Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's An Indigenous Peoples History of the United States. If you don't mind, I'll plug one more thing from my end, or maybe two. I have a book coming out next year with Rutgers University Press for its genocide series called The Politics of Genocide, From the Genocide Convention to the Responsibility to Protect. And the one other thing I'll just note is I'm working on an edited volume now. I mentioned my interest in acknowledging the past to move forward. That will be part of an edited volume that's also contracted with Rutgers called Genocide, The Path Ahead, which takes what I hope is a forward looking rather than, always looking backwards. Scholars are looking at questions about, what does threat of genocide look like in the next 10 to 20 years? How does the concept of genocide maybe need to evolve based on, emerging threats to groups today?
Well, those all sound like fascinating books and fascinating projects of yours. And as I said, I hope you'll join us again to talk about them as they come out. But until then, thank you so much, Jeff, for joining us today. For those listeners, we were talking to Jeffrey Bachman about his new book or his recent book, Cultural Genocide, Law, Politics, and Global Manifestations, published by Routledge. And so thanks, Jeff, and have a great semester.
Thank you, Kelly. You too.